From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, a half hour of commentary, analysis, and maybe even some insight into the media issues of the week. Hello, folks. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, with my colleagues here, Kaylin Brown, a professor from the College of St. Rose.
Hello, Rex.
It is wonderful.
What do you mean, hello, Rex? What about me?
Hello, Alan.
I haven't
Alan.
Introduced you yet. Wait your turn. Dr. Alan Chartok is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, ostensibly the boss of all of us around here, right?
Absolutely.
In your dreams. So anyway, here we go for another opportunity to have some insight. And we're grateful to be joined by a live audience here in the studio, a group of seniors, that is not high school seniors, as Kaylin thought, from the town of Colony, New York, and by Jack Carpenter, who has, through a contribution to a neurofibromatosis charity, he became editor for a day. So he's actually the guy who's going to be ordering around folks at the Times Union, if only I ever got to do such stuff.
So. That's wonderful, Rex. I'm so glad.
How about
raises
that?
For everyone.
Raises, yeah. Not so fast. Anyway, so listen, comes this report from Pew.
When we talk about the Pew Foundation, here we go.
Yeah, absolutely. A research center says that until now, local TV news viewership has been declining slowly, but now from 2016 to 2017, the decline in watching TV news has picked up speed. And so what is going on, it seems, is that television news is falling into the same pattern that hit newspapers about a decade ago.
Well, don't you think it also has something to do with this aberration known as Donald Trump, that the fact of the matter is people just have to get their daily dose of Trumpism to find out how this guy is messing up today? I know that cable news channels couldn't be more delighted with what's happening to them. And I know in the case of this particular public radio station where we're broadcasting from today, we've had $3 million one-day fund drives in a row. And I attribute all of that to Trump.
But also to a listenership who is paying attention to what's happening on this radio station and what this radio station does. I mean, they see this as a contributor to the democracy, I would guess.
Yes.
But, I'm hopeful for that.
But, Kaylin, I think that what they're doing is saying they're scared and they want to be kept up to date on what they consider this aberrant president is doing.
You know, I hate to interrupt and bring data and facts to bear, but that is kind of the role of journalism. And what I was just saying to you
That's
is viewership is dropping, and you're claiming that it's climbing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, especially local viewership is dropping.
More local. Yeah.
And that's what the data shows in this Pew research.
Even cable TV was down by 3 points from 31% of people who say it's where they get their news primarily.
I'm so sorry, Rex.
Well, that's quite all right.
I misheard you. Stop mumbling into your microphone.
But the primary reason that there's television viewership decline has to do with the fact that more people interested in the news are seeking it on the interwebs, I like to say.
On the interwebs.
And so, yes. And so local television news, while it does put its content up there, that is not the place where most viewers would go.
Well, wait a second now. Wait 1 second. Don't you think that we have to make distinctions between the various news organizations? For example, we do not see that happening at WAMC.
That's wonderful. We were talking about television news, but I'm very glad that you're doing really well here. That's great.
That sounds awfully condescending.
No, I'm just trying to stick to the topic.
It's the topic. You think that the fact that people are listening and contributing and being huge parts of what this radio station does has nothing to do with news? No, they make a distinction between the, dare I say it, crap which they get on AM radio stations and in news broadcasts and what public radio brings to them.
I agree, and I love WAMC, and I think it's wonderful that people listen and contribute.
I told you to stop that condescending. sentence.
but even WAMC places podcasts on the interwebs, so you too can have your content heard whenever an individual wants to hear their content. If they missed a program like the Media Project, they know that they can go hear that anytime. They just go to WAMC.org, and then they go to programs, and they scroll down and find the Media Project, and they can hear it in 3 days.
Yes, that's true. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about how many people are listening to us real time. And I'm telling you that more people are listening to this radio station real time than ever did before.
So bring us some data and we can
I'll be glad to do that.
That would be really interesting because the data of the Pew Research Center nationally says that radio has been holding even 2016 to 2017.
Radio.
No, yes, radio.
Well, wait a second.
And television. I know. WAMC is the exception to the rule.
What do you think? Is this the same thing as some verschlugene radio station that preaches the gospel of Trump all day among selling cars?
Or
You gotta be multilingual to get by around here. Come on, Flashugana, absolutely.
Please do tell, Alan.
Flashugana is different from Flashugana.
I know what that other one is.
Yeah. Go ahead.
All right, but the point is, according to the Pew data, which apparently did not take into account WAMC's growing listenership, in 2016, the gap between online and television, the percentage of U.S. adults who often get news in each platform, it was a 19-point gap. It was 57% television in 2016. And 38% internet. Last year, 2017, it was only a 7-point gap. It went from 19 to 7. It was 50 television, 43 internet. And so what that shows is, just as Kaylin is saying, the internet is rising so fast.
Well, what I want to know from both of you geniuses.
Thank you. I think that might have been a little sarcastic, the genius part.
I prefer not to be characterized in the same genius category as some other human we know. Thank you very much.
You like geniuses. I had this question for you. If you're listening on the interweb, as you put it. You can be listening to WAMC on the interweb, or you could be reading the Times Union on the interweb.
That's true.
So the question is, how much of your interweb usage is the old style progenitors of news?
I think that's a great question, you know, and that will be what keeps us alive or not. That's why we're all working so hard to make that transition to digital, because you can't just yield and say, well, the internet is where I get my news. People don't think about what the source of the news on the internet is, right?
Which is why there's so much transparency and explanatory approach being taken by the media in general. They're trying to build out and explain, this is why we do the things we do. And now the news is involved in explaining to its viewership, its readership, its listenership, how it gets done, including when I get my 6 a.m. push from the Times Union mobile app. The Washington Post and New York Times are getting delivered to my mobile app as well every day. So those of us who seek out the news on a regular basis expect the interwebs, the internet, to work well and will benefit us. And it does. It's benefiting people. So it's very accessible.
I have a friend named Michael who, when he hears something that he doesn't either understand or he's a genius, by the way, he is. He says, I see, in the most condescending way. I see.
And the variation is really significant by age. When you, for example, talk about local television, it's much higher among older adults. 57% of Americans 65 or older, which accounts for a couple of us in this room, get...
Not me.
Yeah.
not one of the two.
Me.
57% often get news from television over 65. It drops quickly age 50 to 64. And by the time you're in the 18 to 29-year-old bracket, only 18% say that they regularly get news from television.
And Rex, how do you think that has changed over the years? In other words, were young people ever great consumers of the news?
No, young people were never great consumers of the news. That's absolutely right. But middle-aged people were. It's not a question of how much news they consume. It is partly what's the definition of news, because a lot of stuff that we didn't used to consider news is now being viewed by consumers as news. And then second, it's just how you get it. That's all we're talking about is what mode. And it suggests that a lot of newspapers engaged in some years ago, when you think of joining forces with television stations, was ultimately not really a winning proposition, because television is going down too.
Oh, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I get criticized for that a lot. But let me ask you both a question. So what does this mean? What's the takeaway from what you have just told us, that there are new modalities for receiving information, even though the progenitors of that information are the same people?
So to me, it means that it's a moment of celebration because according to Neil Postman's book on how to watch television news, if individuals are only getting their news information via television and not reading the news, reading a newspaper, then they are not getting enough information. And I remember Ed Daig, who was a local anchor at WNYT, used to come to my classrooms and talk about this. Do not vote if you are not reading a newspaper to supplement your TV consumption, because it's not enough. Television news serves as a headline service. That's what it does. That's all it does. We know. We see the clips when we're out on stories. Print reporters out on a story, and they see a television news reporter holding on to a clip from the Times Union. Again and again. So I think it's valuable that more people are hopefully reading the news and getting the depth and the context, context being critical. TV now, can't deliver that.
Now, let me respond by telling you that I appeared on Channel 13 with Ed Daig for many, many years. Every night, he and I would go at it. And he would say certain provocative things. I find that very provocative. And it's one of my favorite words around here, especially when I'm around Rex, condescending. Because what you're basically saying is, if you only watch television and you don't watch radio, then you shouldn't vote. Now, that's ridiculous. The fact of the matter is, if you're watching, at least watching television and consuming some news, that's better than if you are doing nada, nothing, zinco, forget about it.
That's generally true, although you don't forget the study from a couple of years ago that found that people who watched Fox News as their steady diet of news actually knew less about current events than people who didn't take in much news at all. This was during the Iraq invasion.
I remember that.
And in fact, the reporting was so bad on Fox News that it gave people such bad information, they were less well-informed than people who weren't paying attention to the news. So, I mean,
one could only suspect, I'm sorry for this, Kaylin, one could only suspect the professorate who prepares those kinds of studies, who doesn't like Fox News to begin with, and who therefore comes up with the amazing conclusion that people who watch Fox News are stupid.
That's an interesting analysis.
I didn't say that.
The professorate.
And I like facts. It's not about a particular outlet for the news. It's about true and real facts.
Speaking of facts, the president asserts that there are too few facts, interesting, and says, therefore, we need to take a strong look at America's libel laws, he says, to make it easier for people to sue news organizations and publishers for defamation, so that when somebody says something that is false and defamatory about someone, that person will have a meaningful recourse in the courts, Mr. Trump said.
As we speak today, this is my favorite news story, perhaps of all times. This guy, who is the liar in chief, the Washington Post added up all his lies. I forget whether they are up to 2,000 or 1,000.
They surpassed 2,000 just before he said this, actually.
2,000
factual lies
since
he took office.
Mm-hmm. And now he, crybaby that he is complaining that people are telling lies about him. He's the greatest liar of them all.
That's the irony of this, Alan,
that
right?
That is the irony.
Absolutely.
An overused word, if there ever was one, but in this case, appropriate.
What's interesting is that when he says we want to have laws so that when somebody says something that's false and defamatory, you'll have meaningful recourse in the courts, we have that. That is exactly what American libel laws do. If someone says something false and defamatory that affects you, you do have recourse.
And if it occurs in the media and it's malice, there was some sort of intentional effort to mislead the public or a failure to conduct due diligence, and there was some example of negligence, therein lies the problem.
Well, let me argue that out with you guys just for the sake of having a third person here. We know that if you are in the public eye and if you have inserted yourself into the public eye, you have a much harder time meeting the standards you guys have just talked about, right?
Harder. That is the way the Supreme Court has made it, because you are putting yourself out there. But I would point out
And so Trump is saying, if you lie about me, I can hardly sue, because we have to change those laws so that the Supreme Court dicta in this case, which means that you can say anything you want about a public figure, including not you, Kaylin, but you, Rex, and me. Somebody tells a terrible lie. Now, I listen to a certain AM radio station around here every once in a while. Actually, I don't. I'm lying. But I know very well that they lie about you. And what are you going to do? Sue them? They're protected by the Supreme Court of the United States, who say if you've injected yourself into the political discourse, in other words, if you're famous, you really have very few rights.
Well, you need to buck up and man up and get a thick skin, which is something that he doesn't have. So
I would point out that somebody who was very much a celebrity, Hulk Hogan, remember, brought a libel suit against a major internet site, Gawker Media. Won the libel.
Business.
Yeah, absolutely. Shut them down.
With Peter Thiel's money, though.
Hey, that's true. He had a multimillionaire or billionaire behind him.
Caitlin, why do you say that? I mean, with his money, because you're making a profound point. You go try to sue somebody, you got to have a lot of money to do it.
You do need to have a lot of money. And one of the reasons that the general public doesn't have the same sort of access to the courts as these billionaires and millionaires is because they cannot support a lawsuit of this kind of
depth. Wait, something's terribly wrong here. I agree with you.
Oh, yeah. Yay. That's a first. I'm going to have a great day.
You know, it's kind of amazing that the guy who claimed that Barack Obama wasn't a citizen of the United States and that Ted Cruz his father was behind the JFK assassination, is now concerned about lies to the point that he thinks there need to be a toughening of the laws. By the way, in order to toughen libel laws, you would either need an amendment to the Constitution of the United States that would change the nature of the First Amendment, or you would need, I don't know how else you would do it. You'd have to get courts over time to do it.
Yeah, you might need a First Amendment, an amendment to the Constitution, but you might need some guidance from his Republican friends in the Congress who could pass some kind of law making it easier to sue.
I don't know how you could do that.
Well, it depends on who's on the Supreme Court.
Ah, there you go.
Right now, I wouldn't give you a lot of money on getting the kind of favorable pro-press decision that you're talking about, Rex.
Yeah.
But pro-press is pro-First Amendment.
That's a good
which is a foundation of this country. So wouldn't the Supreme Court want to uphold that?
I don't know. This is a Supreme Court which has a guy named Gorsuch who the president put on there and who has been regularly going along with the president on virtually anything he says right now. And we have one guy who makes a very important justice who makes the decision can go either way.
So it's an interesting situation. You know, here's the thing. The president is not really a great fan of untrammeled free speech. You know, his personal lawyer threatened the publisher of this Michael Wolff book that came out last week, week before last, Fire and Fury. They sent an 11-page cease and desist letter saying, don't publish that book. By golly, if you publish that book, you'll be in big trouble. Well, we don't have free publication restrictions in this country. You know, you cannot stop freedom of speech under the First Amendment. It was an idle threat.
The joke around is, of course, that there are people who think that they paid Trump to do that so that they would sell. They cannot keep up with the number of books that they need to do this. They're frightfully behind.
And the publisher's response to that cease and desist request
was
to up from 150,000 to 1 million copies
and
to rush the deadline and send it out early.
Wow,
so
that's amazing. Right. And the president himself has not been beyond using the libel laws. There's a guy named Tim O'Brien, who's often on cable news, who wrote one of the biographies of the president. This is back when he was a developer before he got active in politics. Trump was furious that Tim O'Brien had supposedly understated his wealth because the notion that he's a multi-billionaire is in doubt. And so he sued him for $5 billion.
And this is a guy, of course, who won't let us see his tax returns.
Right, right.
So you sue somebody for underestimating your wealth, but at the same time, we don't get to learn exactly what his wealth is.
But the courts determined that that was, I believe, specious.
Frivolous. Yeah, they dismissed it out of hand. It was just a...
Well, as we all know, you can threaten to sue somebody if you have a great deal of money and you can hire a stable of lawyers to do it and you force the other person to come up with some money that they may not have. And that is a technique which we have seen used.
There are laws now against that called anti-SLAPP statutes, SLAPP being an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation, so that if you're a citizen and you go to a town board meeting and speak up against a development, for example, that you don't like, there has been a great tradition of those developers then suing the citizen and saying, how dare you oppose this development?
Sure.
And the poor citizen has to, you know, come up with money to hire a lawyer to fight this big developer. So in New York State, we have some not totally powerful, but some laws, anti-SLAPP statutes, to try to restrict the access to the courts by big firms like that trying to shut down public participation.
It's very interesting, Rex.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's the Media Project for Northeast Public Radio. That's Alan Shartok, who is the CEO of Northeast Public Radio and a professor emeritus. So that's why we call him Dr. Shartok. Dr. Kalen Brown. I'm the only person here who's not Dr. Dr. Kalen Brown, longtime news reporter and professor at the College of St. Rose. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. We thank you for joining us. And if you want to participate, send us your thoughts at media@wamc.org. We had to talk a little bit about the way people are doing interviews, the power of journalists and how difficult it is sometimes to do interviews in this age of fiery politics, let's say. Exhibit A, I don't know how many people might have seen the interview between Jake Tapper of CNN and Stephen Miller, the White House senior policy advisor, this rather arrogant young man.
I saw it.
I saw it, too.
It was pretty wild, wasn't it?
Okay, so this was the weekly, Sunday show, right?
Yeah, Jake Tapper's show, Reliable Sources is called. No, what is his show called? Anyway.
Doesn't matter. Okay, so the guy, Miller, who is one of the top Trumpistas, gives him such a hard time and won't answer the questions that Miller cuts short the show and basically kicks him out and says, well, we're getting nowhere.
Tapper cut it short. Yes, Tapper cut Miller short because Miller was not making any meaning, Miller being the...
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what I meant. I'm so sorry. Yeah, that's right. So the question that occurred to me is, if you kick a guy off your air, and I, of course, am a fierce, as you know, disliker of Donald Trump and of Miller and everybody else, but if you kick a guy off your air in the middle of an interview and say, you're not giving me the answers I want, are you basically building an argument against the press?
Yeah, I think it is a difficult thing. You know, your job as an interviewer is to try to get the person you're interviewing to respond to your questions.
Sure.
He was frustrated, understandably, because Stephen Miller wasn't responding to what he was asking. But when you get into such a contentious situation where you're talking over each other and you're constantly at war in front of the cameras, I wonder if you might, at a certain point as a journalist, just say, okay, this is who the White House has sent out. This person is oblivious to facts and is not even trying to respond to the questions. I can see why it was frustrating for Jake Tapper, but I do think that you're right that it probably hurts his image as a journalist.
Yeah, well, because there are a third of this country who believe that Donald Trump walks on water. And when those people are watching something like that, what do they say? They say, you see, the sucker can't even get an even break.
They may be critical of the journalists, but even the people who are supportive of the president, I think, would absolutely recognize that Miller was making no sense, did not complete a thought, and did not contribute any iota of information to that conversation.
As Ronald Reagan would say, there you go again. The fact of the matter is, I don't agree with you. Those 33%, or whatever it is, 35%, who are in love with Donald Trump, who think that the press is evil, or as he says, the enemy of the people, I think that those people think that the press is bad and that this is proof of it.
Yeah, it is a really difficult situation because the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists does not say, when asking questions, let people say what they want and go on. It does not say, report exactly what you see. It says, report the truth. And sometimes the truth is not what people say it is. And so when you try to hold somebody to a standard of truth and say, wait a minute, that's not right. When you try to actually get the truth in an interview, you're doing your journalistic due diligence, but you are making yourself more the enemy of a certain segment of the audience.
Now, Rex, you and I have duked this one out many times. We had a little bit of a tiff on this very show a couple of weeks ago, which we actually played a second time for some bad reason. I don't know. It showed up. And somebody had done an interview here, and you were critical of the interview because the interviewer had not asked the right questions, and therefore you didn't report on what a lot of other people were reporting on, that, you know, this was a bad thing. So, you know, a lot of people think that the press basically is not a fair umpire.
Well, I think that you need to be careful not to allow people, here's the word again, to libel other people. And I think that if you don't ask the tough follow-up questions, you sometimes make that mistake. So you have to be aggressive. It's a hard line. It's why we don't have computers, robots, doing the work of reporters, actually. But we're out of time.
That happened.
We're grateful to the seniors from the town of Colony for joining us. Kalen Brown, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith, we thank you all for joining us on The Media Project.
Such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the world. Now, publishers are such interesting people.
Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.